From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakraborty, and this is On Point. Almost every Western power that has waged war in Afghanistan has withdrawn in defeat. In the past couple of hundred years, the British invaded twice, and in the late 1980s, the Soviets, too, pulled out a decade after a devastating invasion. And after each one and each withdrawal, there has been blowback. Now it's the United States' turn. Afghanistan is America's longest-running war. President Trump says he wants to withdraw half of the U.S. troops there. What would the practical implications be? History shows us how to end an Afghan conflict in the wrong way. But can the U.S. do it differently this time? This hour on Point, the war in Afghanistan through the lessons of history. And you can join us. Do you support withdrawing troops from Afghanistan? Did you serve there? What did you see? Is it possible to pull U.S. troops out while still supporting the development of the Afghan state? Is that something that you have confidence that the U.S. government could do or even wants to do? Or are we doomed to repeat the same mistakes of other Western powers? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. We've got an excellent panel with us today who are going to give us a sense of what's going on in Afghanistan on the ground and throughout history. Joining us in the studio is Thomas Barfield. He is a professor of anthropology at Boston University. He researches systems of local governance and dispute resolution in Afghanistan and is author of Afghanistan: A Cultural and Political History. Professor Barfield, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
Also with us today from Austin, Texas, is Aaron O'Connell. He's a professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also a colonel in the Marine Corps Reserve. He served in Afghanistan as special advisor to General Petraeus and later to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff from 2010 to 2011. He also served as director of defense policy and strategy on the National Security Council in the Obama administration. He edited the 2017 book, Our Latest Longest War. Our Latest Longest War, Losing Hearts and Minds in Afghanistan. Aaron O'Connell, welcome to you.
Thanks, Meghna. It's great to be here.
And I apologize for fumbling through that introduction there. But very grateful that both of you could join us today. And Aaron, let me just start with you. First of all, right now, just give us a sense. If indeed we get to the point where the president as commander-in-chief does begin to draw down troops in Afghanistan, what would the immediate impact be on the ground there?
Well, that would probably depend on the pace of the withdrawal and how it occurs. President Ghani has said that if the U.S. withdraws support, and he means both troops and the financial support for the Afghan army and police, he would say that the army can't sustain operations within 6 months or something like that. That may be overstated. He has a vested interest in extracting as much U.S. aid for as long as possible. But it certainly would decrease the amount of advanced military support that the Afghans are receiving in the field. The president, there are about 14,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan, but they're divided between two missions, a counterterrorism mission, which is a U.S.-only kinetic mission to go after terrorist groups to include senior Taliban, but also ISIS and al-Qaeda. And then the other half, about 8,000, are supporting the Afghan army and police through training. Presumably that's the troops that would be withdrawing. Those are the ones President Trump surged up. He added 4,000 more in August 17. And I think if he did begin cutbacks, it would probably come out of that training mission, not out of the counterterrorism mission. So we would see a diminution of the abilities of the Afghan army and police who are already struggling on the battlefield.
Okay, so that likelihood that you just described, is that what you would advise the president?
I would not advise the president to announce withdrawals on TV without consulting our allies or even his own senior advisors, which is more or less what happened when he hinted at – he hasn't actually announced yet, but he hinted at withdrawing about 7,000 of the U.S. troops to Afghanistan. That doesn't mean that a withdrawal can't be used to the U.S.'s favor. The president tried to surge troops in Afghanistan, as President Obama did before, as President Bush did before him, And it's very clear that the president's little mini surge of 4,000 troops did not work. We can talk about why and the evidence that it didn't work if you like. But we have been doing this for 17 years, and we have no real evidence that U.S. Supporting a fairly feeble Afghan army and police will defeat the Taliban. It didn't happen when President Obama put 100,000 troops there. It's certainly not going to happen with just 14,000 American troops.
I mean, because here's the central question that we want to sort of engage with through this hour, that we've seen multiple times in history is that when Western powers invade Afghanistan, we can talk about the reasons why and what happened, but the manner of withdrawal then down the line sets up for some kind of blowback. I mean, is that possible here, or is it all but guaranteed? Because as far as I'm seeing, for example, the Taliban is not at all contained or not sufficiently contained. And in fact, the United States is negotiating right now with the Taliban on what a potential exit strategy might look like?
Correct. Right. The question that underlies all of this is whether or not the United States is providing germane and essential support to the Afghan army and police, whether it is providing only additional helpful auxiliary support, or whether, in fact, it is making the problem worse. Now, we can discuss different people have different opinions on that. But if you think that they're making things worse, then you could conceivably forge a path to peace by pulling the troops out. If you think that that support is germane and that the entire army and police will collapse, then yes, you are going down the same path as some previous parts of Afghan history, where when the occupying power or the funding power withdrew its funding and support, it opened up a real opportunity for numerous groups to descend into chaos and to vie for control in Afghanistan.
Well, you've provided us with the perfect opportunity to turn to Thomas Barfield here. And Professor Barfield, I want to just play a bit of tape for you. It's this issue of how the West engages with Afghanistan just comes up over and over again in history. And this is a remarkable piece of tape we have here. It's former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev speaking through an interpreter in 2011 at the Lyndon Johnson Presidential Library. And of course, the Soviets invaded Afghanistan in the late 70s through the 80s. And he talked about the fact that he had a discussion about Afghan history and Western engagement with Afghanistan with none other than former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. So here's Mikhail Gorbachev.
I talked to Margaret Thatcher years ago, and she said, "You made a bad mistake by going into Afghanistan. Why hadn't you sought our advice, the advice of the British, before giving in? We had been trying for 100 years to handle Afghanistan, and we failed. So we, too, spent 10 years in Afghanistan, and we learned the lessons."
That's former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev talking about a conversation he had with Margaret Thatcher about the lessons that both the Soviets and the British learned in their multiple withdrawals and defeats from Afghanistan. Thomas Barfield, what are the lessons that the British learned the hard way, that the Soviets learned the hard way, that the United States needs to learn and think about right now?
Well, every invading power of Afghanistan, once they have invaded and they've all found invasion very easy, victory seems to come very quickly, they quickly move up and decide they will remake Afghanistan in its own image. After considerable amount of warfare and usually a certain number of at least tactical defeats, they all leave Afghanistan deciding the Afghans can run it any way they want as long as they don't cause neighboring powers any problems. So the big change is pretty much the goals. Margaret Thatcher may have exaggerated. The British never spent more than 3 years in Afghanistan. They got out the quickest. But they also put their own people in charge and aided them. So did the Soviets. So what we find is the great powers get out, but they often leave their clients behind. And as long as they are funded and given arms, insurgencies are able to get rid of foreigners. But it turns out no insurgency has ever toppled a government in Kabul that's gotten financial and military support.
Okay. So as long as the support is there.
That, it turns out, is more important than the troops.
Okay. And so then, so what's the lesson there to draw? I mean, if there's a right way for the United States to withdraw from Afghanistan now, how do we apply this history to the current moment?
In each case, the invading power installed a very weak leader, because a weak leader will do what you want. When they withdrew, the British and the Russians put in a strong leader. The Americans have never really faced the point of a leader ruling Afghanistan with American troops there. It's useful if that person is a weak personality. He does what you say. The difficulty is when you cut that cord is finding an Afghan who thinks he can rule Afghanistan if you give him the resources and is absolutely committed to do it. The Soviets thought that the communist government would collapse in 6 months, but they got rid of weak leaders. They put in President Najibullah, who had been head of the secret service in Afghanistan, and his nickname in Afghanistan was the Bull. And even though the Mujahideen hated him, they respected him as a very powerful leader. No one respected the early communist leaders. And the same thing with the British. They put in powerful leaders who essentially brought order to Afghanistan on Afghan terms.
But about the Soviet invasion and it, and its subsequent withdrawal, though, after the Soviets left in actually 30 years ago this year.
Yes.
But it wasn't also – it definitely was not smooth sailing in Afghanistan after that.
It certainly wasn't. But the Soviets assumed when they pulled out – and they pulled all their troops out. They kept the money and arms flowing. But – they expect the Afghan government would collapse in 6 months, and then they could blame it on the Afghans. The interesting thing is the Afghan government collapsed after the Soviet Union collapsed. Only when the Soviet Union collapsed and there was no aid coming to the government did the Afghan government collapse. That took everybody by surprise. It took the United States by surprise, me surprised, because I thought, yeah, as soon as the Soviets are gone, it'll collapse. And that taught me a lesson. There's more going on in Afghanistan that meets the eye.
Well, Aaron O'Connell, we have 30 seconds here before we have to take a quick break. But do you see in President Ghani right now that strong leader that Thomas Barfield is talking about?
No. I don't know who a leader would be right now that could corral all of Afghanistan's ethnic factions. And the political stalemate in the country is worse than it ever has been before, which we can go over if you like.
Yeah. So we'll talk more about that when we come back. We're talking about the lessons from history that the United States, that the U.S. administration ought to be taking a close look now when it comes to withdrawing from Afghanistan. Aaron O'Connell joins us. He's a professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin and a colonel in the Marine Corps Reserve. Thomas Barfield also joins us, an anthropology professor at Boston University and author of Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. We've got a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the lessons that history can impart to the United States as it is considering, or the president, I should say, is considering withdrawing half of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. We're joined today by Thomas Barfield. He's a professor of anthropology at Boston University and author of Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. Aaron O'Connell is also with us. He's a professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin, served in Afghanistan as a special advisor to General Petraeus and later to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs in 2010 and 2011. And so, Aaron and Thomas, I just want to play a little bit of tape here because we started talking about the Soviet experience in Afghanistan. And as we mentioned, it just happens to be 30 years ago that the Soviets finally withdrew from 10 years of warfare in Afghanistan. Here's Mike Lee of ABC News reporting from Kabul on February 15th, 1989, the day Soviet troops finally withdrew from the country.
This was Kabul's first sunrise in 9 years with no Soviet tanks or troops in sight. But there was a convoy of Soviet relief supplies, food, fuel, and munitions, which had managed to break through a blockade of rebels surrounding the city. Key locations, including the airport, are now guarded by units of the communist Afghan regime, led by President Najibullah, who faces a war of attrition.
It's the day Soviet troops withdrew from Afghanistan in 1989. And of course, the United States had a very key role to play in the conflict in Afghanistan when the Soviets were there. Here's President Reagan following a meeting with Afghan Mujahideen resistance leaders in November of 1987, 8 years after the initial invasion, about the Soviets' initial invasion in Afghanistan. And of course, President Reagan pledged to continue supporting them.
A just struggle against foreign tyranny can count upon worldwide support, both political and material. The goal of the United States remains a genuinely independent Afghanistan, free from external interference. An Afghanistan whose people choose the type of government they wish.
That's President Ronald Reagan in 1987. Thomas Barfield, reflect on what we heard in these clips here. I mean, were there things that the United States did in the 80s that perhaps, I guess there definitely were, that set up Afghanistan and the rest of the West for the ongoing conflicts that then, of course, led to September 11th?
Well, there were two things. One, you heard the promise that was made often that if the Soviets left, the United States would support an independent Afghanistan and would rebuild the country. And instead, once the Soviets withdrew, American interest disappeared. The other thing to remember is all the aid that came from the United States was funneled through Pakistan.
Right.
And Pakistan did not want to see an independent Afghanistan. It saw it as an opportunity through its clients to take control. And what they told the Americans was there's no need to negotiate, as the Soviets did, for a stable coalition government. Kabul had not been destroyed at that point. They said, we can win militarily. And the United States essentially said, so go ahead and try. And that led, with the lack of American aid and with Pakistani interference, once the Najibullah regime collapsed in 92, to a 10-year civil war. That led to the Taliban. That led to al-Qaeda. But essentially, as far as the Afghans were concerned, the American promise of aid, stability, was a promise we didn't keep.
Does this problem of Pakistan still exist then, though, right? Because the Pakistani state shows no desire to stop supporting the Taliban, and it's U.S. aid money that's going to Pakistan, then you could argue it's going to support the Taliban.
Yeah, this is an irony, is that we pay billions to support the Afghan government. We give money to Pakistan that pays millions to support the Taliban. It's an insurgency by proxy. If there was no aid coming into Afghanistan from all sides, the Afghans could probably come to an agreement. They have in the past. But to some extent, Pakistan has always been the sticking point. It does not want to see peace in Afghanistan.
So Aaron O'Connell, then, regardless of how many troops, U.S. troops are in Afghanistan, this is a theme that's already come up a couple of times. It's sort of the financially, where will the money go? Who will it go to? Geopolitically, how should the United States handle other countries in the region if it wants stability in Afghanistan?
Right. Yeah, I would like to agree with Dr. Barfield. I think he's exactly right that if we withdraw all funding, and as every previous insurgency has experienced in Afghanistan, if there is no external aid to the Afghan National Security Forces, then you are likely to see, a devolution. I think you're likely to see much more violence. But the United States has actually gone about this in a ham-handed way for 17 years. So there's a misdiagnosis of the problem going on. The reason we provide $5 billion in funding to the Afghan National Security Forces is because we argue they're too weak to handle. They're under-resourced and they're untrained. They can't do it on their own. That's not entirely accurate. State weakness isn't really the problem. There's a fabulous new book out on this by a Carnegie senior fellow named Rachel Kleinfeld. It's called A Savage Order. I recommend it to all your readers. But it shows us that state weakness isn't the problem, because in almost all of the most violent countries in the world, the state is in some way complicit in the violence. That because there is such a poor infrastructure for the government and such poor accountability, portions of the state actually strike bargains and extract resources from the people instead of protecting and respecting them. So the key for the U.S., for what it should do with its troops and indeed its funding for Afghanistan, is to break this bargain between the bad elements of the state that are predatory and extractive. And that's possible. We give them an enormous amount of money. We have 14,000 troops there. Mm-hmm. If we are going to withdraw troops and even talk about reducing funding, we must link that directly to the worst units in the Afghan army and police, the ones with the egregious human rights records, the units and the government ministries that can't even provide records of their people or their finances or the fuel they've used. If we do that, it is possible to present a clear message to the Afghan government. If you want our help, you have to use taxpayer dollars in accordance with U.S. law and in accordance with U.S. treaty commitments. The Pentagon has waived those requirements away, legally, has been able to waive those requirements, saying it's just too dangerous right now, the security situation is too precarious, but that misses the point that it's not state weakness, it's in fact portions of the state are corrupt and we need to cut those parts out.
Okay.
I don't think that's remaking the world in America's image. I think that's insisting that U.S. dollars be used in accordance with U.S. law.
But is there a chicken and egg problem here, though? To put it bluntly, I mean, if the Pentagon is saying that the security situation isn't adequate enough, I mean, how do we have to wait for that? And can we wait for that?
Or can we
achieve the security?
We have tried.
Can we achieve the security situation with the problematic players still in place, as you were talking about?
Right. Well, we've tried for 17 years to just keep saying we'll do that later. So it is perhaps time for a change. And the president's withdrawal announcement provides that leverage. It's true, security may reduce if we cut off funding from some units, but it will also make it very hard for the Afghan government to keep saying, oh, we're working on it, when they're not really working on it.
Yeah. Well, let's go to a caller here. James is calling from Saranac Lake, New York. James, you're on the air.
Hi. Just had a kind of a thing I've been noting with seeing, you know, all these different regimes such as us or Russia or Britain go in there and they keep doing the same thing, expecting a different result. And it seems to me that we play all this lip service about an independent, you know, Afghanistan. I think maybe the best option is just to completely pull out, leave the place be and let it do whatever it's going to do, or just be honest and make it another territory. Take it over. I mean, Afghanistan, the Middle East, is not going to be like the U.S. They're not going to care about U.S. tax dollars or our laws or anything else. So we either install our own government, make it basically, like I said, a territory, treat it as such, which would probably reduce the violence, or just completely pull out and let the place be, because this middle ground historically has never worked. And what's the old thing about insanity, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result?
Well, James, thank you for your call. Thomas Barfield, how do you respond to James?
Well, he's partially correct in terms of looking at the frustration. But Afghanistan's history is so long and there have been so many foreign invasions that we actually have essentially templates for every possibility. The possibility of a quick withdrawal and just getting out is the template of the 1990s, when first we got a civil war and then we got the Taliban, is that when Afghanistan falls apart, that's when we see sort of radical elements coming up. We assume that if Afghans killed one another, they're on the other side of the world. It was only after 9/11 that we realized letting that fester was probably not the best policy. The other thing of taking it over as a territory, I don't think the United States is interested in that. It would meet a huge amount of opposition. But there's a third point, and that is putting Afghans in charge who want to see a future for Afghanistan itself. Afghanistan has one of the youngest populations in the world. The majority, just a slight majority, has been born since the United States has been in there. This new generation is actually not come out of the same experience of these old warlords. And if you look at a younger generation moving up the political line, there actually presents some possibilities. Also, Afghanistan is becoming urbanized. Never wasn't urbanized before. Taliban have no support in urban areas. So there's different political factions there that have not been around before.
Interesting. So it's a new wrinkle there that we haven't seen before. Because when in James's call, what I was hearing was sort of this thundering echo of history and sort of his very binary view of the options in Afghanistan. Because I mentioned at the very, very beginning of the conversation, Churchill and the British experience there in the 19th century. And I mean, Churchill was, what, 23 years old when he was in Afghanistan with British troops?
He was actually never in Afghanistan. He was in the Northwest Frontier area.
The Northwest Frontier area. Okay. Okay.
The last time the British were in Afghanistan was 1880.
Got it. Okay. This is why we have an expert at the table with us here. But regarding sort of the region, I mean, in his book, The Story of the Malakand Field Force,
yes,
Churchill writes about two options, but mentions a third. He says the first course is that of a bad and nervous sailor. Withdraw entirely, essentially. And by the way, I have to put a hat tip out to Robert Kaplan, who I read a recent article of his that he wrote about this. Second course that Churchill said was full steam ahead, like sort of making, quote, the area as safe and civilized as Hyde Park. So full engagement, nation building for as long as possible. But then Churchill also mentions a third course, what he calls a system of gradual advance of political intrigue among tribes, of subsidies and small expeditions. Did the British ever try that? Did the Soviets? Should the U.S.? Is that what we're talking about here?
You may remember the part of Pakistan known as Fatah, the federally administered tribal area. Mm-hmm. This is what the British did. They said, we will rule directly in the areas where the Pashtuns live, where there's a high population, the people that live in the mountains. We will give subsidies to their tribal chiefs, and if they misbehave, we'll send punitive campaigns up for the summer and out, or will cut off their trade. But yes, in fact, Pakistan's problem with the whole tribal area is a legacy of this indirect, where Pakistan claims sovereignty over a territory it actually doesn't control. And at a longer range, that was the British attitude towards Afghanistan. Pay the emir of Afghanistan to keep order. And the emirs did. And we won't ask too many questions as long as he doesn't bother the British.
Okay. Well, Aaron O'Connell, though, I was just intrigued by Churchill saying that this third course, as we're talking about, he called it undignified, but he said it was the only alternative, a true workable alternative for a Western power in Afghanistan. Is there a 2019 version of this?
yes, maybe. I mean, you know, the old saying, history doesn't repeat itself, but sometimes it rhymes. Obviously, we can look back to the experience of previous armies in Afghanistan, and there are some rhyming couplets that are worth paying attention to. But the military force of the United States, ability to put a missile thousands of miles away without a single troop on the ground, is radically different from mm-hmm. what Churchill was experiencing in the northwest frontier province of Pakistan. So I think the important point for this whole conversation is to go back to what are the United States' enduring interests in the region, and we do have some. And they're effectively twofold. First of all, there are transnational terrorist groups in Afghanistan and in Pakistan. Now, some of those have transnational reach. Some of those are planning and conducting attacks, trying to get outside of that region and to attack other Western interests, including our country. That is an interest for the United States. We have to restrict terrorist organizations to what are effectively unusable safe havens. We don't have to wipe them out everywhere in the world, and maybe keeping them at the top of the Hindu Kush is a pretty good place to contain them. But we can't ignore them. That's a terrible idea. And cutting and running is effectively a strategy to just ignore them, to say, whatever, who cares, is what we did after the 1990s, and that did not work out well for us. The second national interest we have is to prevent a Taliban takeover. Mm. Now, it's not likely by any means at this point, but completely cutting off all aid to the Afghan government, willy-nilly, care what comes, is probably not a good idea, and it's not one that I suggest. If the government collapses completely or has zero control over the country, then there will be far more productive safe havens for transnational terrorist groups. Those are our interests, and we can target resources towards those interests. The two choices are not pay forever or run away. We need to have a bias for nuance when we talk about this. And I think that there is a way to restrict funding, to target funding, and to put conditions on funding. That's how diplomacy works. It can work successfully. And let's be clear that the non-military aid to Afghanistan, to double down on what Professor Barfield said, the non-military economic assistance has created an entire generation in the cities that are effectively a functional middle class. Mm-hmm. And that this is the way where government responsibility steps up because the middle class demands it. It is the way out of violence. And I don't think we should cut all that aid and assistance just because it seems hard to do.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Since you mentioned the Taliban, I want to just play a little bit of a sound here from retired General Stanley McChrystal, the former top U.S. commander in Afghanistan. He was very critical of the president when President Trump announced that he wants to withdraw half of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. This was McChrystal on ABC's This Week last Sunday.
He basically traded away the biggest leverage point we have. If you tell the Taliban that we are absolutely leaving on date certain, cutting down, weakening ourselves, their incentives to try to cut a deal drop dramatically.
That's retired General Stanley McChrystal. Thomas Barfield, let me just turn back to you here. We've got a minute to go before the break. Just to underscore again, negotiations have been underway between Taliban leaders and the U.S. or through the U.S. Special Envoy Zalmay Khalilzad. But just on Sunday, the Taliban said they wouldn't attend planned talks this month because they want to change the venue there. But what's your response to what McChrystal said?
Well, McChrystal's right, but it was under President Obama that a surge went in with absolute dates that we're going to get out. This has been a problem that Americans have had for a long time. They announce great invasions or increases of troops and then announce for political domestic reasons they will be out at a certain point. The Taliban heard it in 2010. They're hearing it now. The basic problem the Taliban have is in a stalemate. Do they want to remain in the desert on the mountaintops for the next 20 years, dying, as was mentioned, at the hands of precision drones? I mean, you know, there's good reason for them, not the ones in Pakistan, but the ones dying on the ground, to come to some kind of reconciliation. And if it looks like the great powers are leaving, it's even more important for the Taliban to come together so that they're not beholden entirely to Pakistan.
Well, as you know, I love to see the shadows of history everywhere. And just as a small aside, General McChrystal, when he was commanding U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan, was said to listen to the writings of Churchill on his iPod when he would take his daily jogs in Afghanistan. Well, we are talking about what lessons history might have for the U.S. now as President Trump says he wants to withdraw half of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the lessons that history has for the United States as President Trump considers or says he wants to pull out half of the U.S. troops on the ground in Afghanistan. I'm joined today by Thomas Barfield. He's a professor of anthropology at Boston University and author of Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. Aaron O'Connell also joins us. He's professor of history at the University of Texas, Austin, a colonel in the Marine Corps Reserve, and he served in Afghanistan as special advisor to General Petraeus and later to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs from 2010 to 2011. He also edited our latest, longest war losing hearts and minds in Afghanistan. And Thomas and Aaron, we've got a lot of comments coming in online, folks saying, for example, Rod Prince saying that the same military who saw the Soviet stalemate thought it could be any different for us. It boggles the mind. John Cogswell says Afghanistan is what happens when you try to apply a tactical solution to a political problem over and over and over again. And Carol Gibbons is telling us the lesson here is that we should not get involved with other countries' problems, period. Well, let's go to Linda, who's calling from Salem, New York. Linda, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. My question had to do with addressing our national security interests there, which your commenters have spoken about a bit. But specifically, Afghanistan is a potential resource for rare earth minerals that really haven't had much mining development. They're necessary for computer processors, and currently the number one mining place for that is China. Mm-hmm. And just like we don't want all of our oil to come from one place, I was wondering if your experts could address that.
Linda, thank you so much for your call. Thomas Barfield, let me turn to you first on that, because I'm glad she brought up China, because China and, for example, India, we also talked about Pakistan. There are a lot of regional players here who could and should and will have quite a bit of influence over what happens in Afghanistan. Your thoughts on that?
Yes. One of the things that America, withdrawing even down to the present level, it's really focused the regional powers on the stability of Afghanistan because they can't move. They live in the neighborhood. China has an absolute paranoia about Islamic radicalism. India is worried about terrorism. Iran actually is in sync with the United States for not wanting to see a radical Sunni group arise on its other border. The Central Asian states don't want to see any trouble. But it's also, as the caller noticed, Afghanistan is not intrinsically a poor state. It has some of the largest mineral deposits in the world. The Indians, although they never went through, signed a $10 billion agreement with the Afghans for iron mines in the central Afghanistan to build a steel industry. China signed a $3 billion agreement for copper mines south of Kabul. It said that not only are there rare earths, but Afghanistan has large deposits of lithium. None of this can be developed, however, without infrastructure and without political stability.
So could China play a stabilizing role here?
It could. The irony of there is that its biggest ally in the region is Pakistan, which is fomenting instability. And China's begun to realize that because their whole belt highway system running through Pakistan is running right through a lot of these regions. And just as the Islamists hated the Soviet Union, but they hated us next, the Chinese could well be in line on that. How are they supposed to send Chinese engineers into these areas to develop it without stability? And Pakistan seems to be keen on fomenting stability. That runs against China's interest, economic interests.
Right.
So there is some possibility there, and the Chinese have actually been looking at that. India has always had very good relations with Kabul governments because even though Pakistan and Afghanistan are Islamic, they've always been rivals. And so Kabul and Delhi have historically forged alliances, something that Pakistan is afraid of. So yeah, this is really focused the interests not only politically because if there's blowback, they're the ones that live there. If there's terrorism, India will be the first victim. China is just across the border. So there's this is focusing them, and we could work harder on it's other than Pakistan, everybody else in the region would like to see stability in Afghanistan.
Okay, so Aaron O'Connell, you just heard Thomas Barfield say we could be working harder on these regional allies and regional players. Do you see that as part of a plan coming out of a potential plan coming out of the White House or the Pentagon?
Yes, it's a plan, and it was noted in the president's August 2017 announcement of a new strategy, which wasn't actually a new strategy. So a renewed diplomatic effort both with Pakistan and with India. The president's special envoy, who you mentioned earlier, Zalmay Khalilzad, collectively known as Zal, is doing this, and he's doing it well. There have been some breakthroughs and some early meetings, but these are all still talks to talk about talking. They are not actual negotiations. You need a bargain that does involve everybody in the region. And the problem here for the United States is some of our sort of most troublesome states are actually also have an ability to spoil any plans we have for Afghanistan. Iran can spoil. Pakistan can spoil. Russia can even spoil. So we need a bargain that involves all of them. That's clear. Zal has been working on that. One of the more unfortunate things is in President Trump's cabinet meeting last week, he actually said, let's let India and Pakistan and Russia fight it out in Afghanistan. That is by far the worst thing any American president could say right now about negotiations in Afghanistan. That is, while we have national security interests that have to do with the Taliban and they have to do with the Afghan state and transnational terrorism, the broader national interest, global interest, is to prevent an actual confrontation between India and Pakistan, a lethal confrontation in Afghanistan. So it is a tricky needle we're trying to thread here, but it's not impossible. It doesn't just mean the choices are leave or double down. We have leverage that we can deploy. And as Dr. Barfield noted, weirdly enough, Iran is actually on the same side as us. It really comes down to pushing Pakistan and to pushing the Afghans to reconcile amongst themselves. So we have to get them to some kind of bargain.
We have to be more flexible on what we're willing to accept. Throughout the Obama administration, we had a series of preconditions. We have abandoned some of those, which I think is wise for even starting talks. But it has to be solved in the region, and we have to use diplomacy, which can work if you give it a shot.
You know, since you mentioned what the president said last week at that cabinet meeting, there was another moment which we have to take a slight detour to talk about this because it got a lot of people's attention. And since I have two experts with me on the program, I want to get your response to what the president said when he basically mischaracterized, to put it lightly, the reasons for the Soviet Union's late 1970s invasion of Afghanistan. Here is what the president said.
The reason Russia was in Afghanistan was because terrorists were going into Russia. They were right to be there. The problem is it was a tough fight. And literally they went bankrupt. They went into being called Russia again as opposed to the Soviet Union. You know, a lot of these places you're reading about now are no longer part of Russia because of Afghanistan.
That's President Donald Trump last week at a cabinet meeting. Thomas Barfield, everyone that I've read who's analyzed what the president said says that there's not a word in there or a phrase in there that was accurate or true. Is that correct?
Yes. I think there's been almost universal jaw-dropping agreement that was the most egregious misstatement of fact coming ever out of the Oval Office. And that's a long time because the Soviets intervened to protect a communist regime. The people they called terrorists were the people who responded to that invasion. But they went in there and Afghanistan had been at peace for 50 years. They went in there and turned the place upside down to protect a communist government because the Brezhnev Doctrine said that no socialist state can be allowed to leave socialism. They treated it like Czechoslovakia. Americans don't usually know very much about Afghanistan, but that's something that's not even alternative history. That's like invented history. And I think even Vladimir Putin would not accept that as how Russians look at Afghanistan.
Well, and the Soviets invading Afghanistan to prop up the communist government there is exactly why the United States then went and supported the Mujahideen, who were fighting against the Soviets.
It was a Cold War.
Yeah. Aaron O'Connell, can you make any sense as to why the president may have said this last week?
I think we would get nowhere trying to guess what's inside his head. I mean, there's an old joke here, right, that God created war so that Americans would learn geography. And I think that's apt today. Not only did the Soviets he said Russia invaded, which is, you know, interesting because terrorists were going into Russia. Well, Russia is 1,500 miles away from Afghanistan, right? So there's some problems here. Some people have suggested that perhaps the president was confusing the Russian intervention in Chechnya a decade later. That is possible. It doesn't make me feel any better about it. I don't think it should make anyone feel any better. But everything else he said was wrong, too. He also said that the war bankrupted the Soviet economy, which is not true. It helped, but that was mostly about oil prices and indeed command-controlled economy problems. And then he said the Soviets were right to be in Afghanistan, which is just horrible. I mean, this is an invasion that not only violated the UN Charter and was roundly condemned by almost the entire international community, but killed 1 million Afghan civilians and left another 6 million as refugees. I believe in a foreign policy grounded to our values. And so that was one of the things that really made my heart sink.
Yeah. Well, let's get one more call in here. Let's go to Paul, who's calling from Montreal, Quebec in Canada. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I felt compelled to call in because I haven't heard a discussion about NATO. And given the fact that, yes, after the Soviets left Afghanistan, it wasn't just the U.S., but there were troops from many nations cooperating to deal with the situation and what to do. And Canadian troops lost their lives as well as other European countries. So I just wanted to throw that out in terms of this perspective. I really appreciate the latest discussion you've been having about some background. But, you know, the idea that it's not just the U.S. that was involved with some sort of program of what to do with Afghanistan, but it was NATO, although now I believe NATO is really not so much involved. And thank you for that. I had a good laugh about wars were created so Americans could discover the world living Paul, in Canada.
Paul, thank you so much for your call. Aaron O'Connell, let me turn back to you. Paul saying that perhaps we should be discussing more of NATO and other and our allies' presence in Afghanistan and their role as well.
I think so, yes. NATO is still there. Indeed, half of the train and assist mission is done by NATO. There are about 8,500 Americans doing the train and advise and assist, and the remainder of the 16,000, about half, are from NATO countries, 39 different countries that are providing troops. And that's really important because, let's be clear about this, the NATO community invoked Article 5 over 9/11 and said this is in fact dangerous to the world to have transnational terrorist groups, even if they are in the mountains of Afghanistan, if they can get to us. So it is a problem for international security, and they've committed to doing something about it. It is possible that if we start pulling our troops out of Afghanistan, our NATO partners will follow. And I think that that's a bad thing. I don't think that we would do well to completely withdraw both the troops and the funding for the Afghan National Defense Forces.
Yeah. Well, you know what, Thomas Barfield, there's a question I should have asked a little earlier when we were talking about the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Right now, in 2019, what are Russia's interests in the fate of Afghanistan, or how the U.S. handles this moment?
Well, it's not quite clear. Early on, Russia was quite cooperative. In the Obama administration, they allowed overflights so that we could get supplies into Afghanistan. And historically, at least up until recently, they've been more concerned about leakage across the border into Central Asia, which is now independent, but causing essentially disruptions in Russia eventually. As was mentioned, they had a problem with Chechnya. Right now, it may be cynical, but I think to some extent Putin sees it as useful to cause trouble for the United States. But it's not clear to me. As mentioned, Russia itself is actually quite far now from Afghanistan. So and it's in competition with China over Central Asia. So it's one of the problems of looking at Afghanistan, a lot of countries, beginning with the United States, it's actually not really clear what their policies are.
Yeah. Well, let's get one more call in here if we can. Charles is calling from Brunswick, Maine. Charles, you're on the air.
Thank you very much for taking my call. This is the best program on Afghanistan that I have ever heard, and I've heard a lot of them. Just a tiny little footnote. It's well to remember that the reason we withdrew from Afghanistan after the Soviet withdrawal was the fact that there was an amendment to our Foreign Assistance Act called the Pressler Amendment that denied us the ability to continue supporting a country that had a nuclear program. We had ignored the fact, we had known about it for 5 years. We decided to put it into effect once the Soviets left Afghanistan.
Charles, may I just jump in here for a second? Wait, don't go away. Are you former Ambassador Charles Dunbar who's calling in?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I just want so because you have a certain degree of knowledge that you've brought to the table. And so ambassador formerly to Qatar, to Yemen, you worked at the State Department.
I do. I simply want to say that Tom Barfield has forgotten more about Afghanistan than I ever will know. And I can't find my notes about the UT professor. But it sounds like he might be in that same category as well.
Well, that's Aaron O'Connell that you were referencing there. Charles Dunbar from Brunswick, Maine, former State Department, former ambassador as well. Thank you so much for calling in. Look, Thomas Barfield and Aaron O'Connell, we just have less than 60 seconds to go here. But I just wanted to get very brief last thoughts from you. It sounds like what you're both saying is that really ideally what we want to avoid in Afghanistan is withdrawing from the country in a way that leaves chaos in its wake, a weak government, surrounding states that are fomenting instability. Because in that chaotic vacuum, that's when anarchy moves in and, for example, Islamic extremism once again takes hold. But do you have confidence that that is how the United States is positioned to leave Afghanistan, with stability and no chaos?
It's not, but it's possible to do, and I hope that cooler heads will prevail.
Aaron O'Connell, you got 15 seconds here. Your last thought.
I agree with Professor Barfield.
You hope that cooler heads will prevail.
I sure do.
All right. Well, Aaron O'Connell, professor of history at the University of Texas, Austin, a colonel in the Marine Corps Reserve. He served in Afghanistan as a special advisor to General Petraeus and later the joint chairman of the Joint Chiefs. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Thomas Barfield, professor of anthropology at Boston University and author of Afghanistan, a cultural and political history. Thank you.
And thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.